Yeah, thank you. I'd like to also thank the organizers for putting together this session. So one of the things that, and it's also a little unnerving to follow your advisor so quickly in the same session, but one of the things that we're interested in, and Scott talked about just a couple minutes ago, was the differences in aerobic and anaerobic conditions and how that relates to carbon fluxes. And if you look at the sort of global distribution of wetlands, you can see there are a number of different types. And where we're going to focus is on some differences between upland and lowland wetlands, some that are seasonally and permanently saturated. And those occur down in Southeast Asia. And one of the reasons we focus there is it's also an area where there's the large deltas of the world, basically, that drain the Himalaya. And there's also a concentration of population there. And so it's quite a dynamic environment that, with changes coming with climate change, changes predicted in the South Asian monsoon, and also in land use change in that area, we're interested in how carbon is cycling in these areas. And so to kind of zoom in on, to give an example of what these areas look like in the wet and dry season, this is in the upper Mekong Delta, and you can see is there a pointer or something? I can use that. Can you see this up here? Okay, up here is the Tonle Sap, and you can see that this is an area that expands and contracts annually, and it changes the size of this wetland throughout the entire delta. This is a flooded area in the wet season, and the same area shown in the dry season. So there are these annual pulses of flooding and drying that happen over a large area in this delta. This is the second largest delta in the world. And what's causing this is changes in water level that are up to 10 meters, and in some areas of the upper Mekong, averaging maybe 6 to 8 meter changes in river stage annually. This is an example from Phnom Penh, where you can see from the same area changes in a river stage. And so one of the main questions that we're asking in this study is how much carbon is stored in seasonal versus permanent wetlands, wetlands that never really experience a time when they fully dry out or don't have standing water over them and don't get, they're basically limited in the amount of oxygen that can diffuse into the sediments. And so this is kind of conceptualized here, where you have a dry season water table, where even during the dry season, you have a permanently saturated wetland that's underwater, and during the wet season, where you have an area that everything is flooded. And so we nominally refer to these as seasonally and permanently saturated wetlands. And so what some of these look like is this what a seasonally saturated wetland might look like? And the only time we can excavate it is during the dry season. And so this is about a 6 meter pit that we dug in Cambodia. This is what we'll call a near surface saturation wetland. And this is an area where the water table, we couldn't actually excavate very deep because the water table remains relatively close to the surface. And then we have areas that are permanently saturated. And all of these are within about a 10 to 20 square kilometer area of each other. And so we're trying to minimize variations in most other variables. And so just to give an example of what seasonal saturation looks like at this site, this is the same stand with a data logger in it at two different seasons. And so we have up to a few meters of water standing over this area and then drying it down where we can excavate a 6 meter pit. So there are really large changes in hydrology here. The same thing happens at near surface saturated areas, but like I said, the water table here remains relatively near to the surface. In areas where there's permanent saturation, this is essentially a lake, an oxbow lake, wetland lakes that remain flooded. And in this case, we use homemade sort of boat or raft equipment to take cores, and we can't actually get into the sediments here physically. And so if we just take a first look at what the bulk carbon content looks like in these different areas, the seasonally saturated wetlands have a profile that fairly rapidly drops off and then stabilizes basically through the top 4 meters. And what's not shown here is there is a a peat layer at about 6 meters, but for that goes up to about 20% carbon. But for clarity, I've just kind of I've cut it off at 4 meters, where everything can be compared without this sort of outlier in the area. The near surface sediments have generally a little bit higher carbon content near the surface, and then tend to just they seem to be pretty close through the middle, and then have somewhat higher carbon content throughout the profile. And I think this is maybe a little small, but it's a little difficult to see. But there are some patches here that we noticed that are, it's not a really stratified profile like we saw here, where there's nice depositional zones here. This is much more mixed up in terms of the depositional history of it as well. And then when we look at the carbon content of permanently saturated areas that come from lake cores, we have quite a lot higher carbon content near the surface, and generally, I think, more carbon through the profile, especially compared to a seasonal wetland. And one of the things that we're interested in is not just the bulk carbon content, but also the reactivity. And so a way we can do this, at least with sediments from Cambodia, is to use a proxy. And what we've started to use is a permanganate oxidizable carbon extraction. And if we basically look at this, this is in the amount of carbon that's oxidized by permanganate in a defined reaction time. And it's used as a proxy for the microbial availability, or some kind of indicator of how easily the carbon could be processed. And so we see a similar trend with bulk carbon. This is in milligrams per kilogram of sediment. So it's the milligrams of carbon that are oxidized per kilogram of dry sediment. And we nominally see a higher permanganate oxidizable carbon again in the near surface wetland, and then see a similar trend to bulk carbon. And so we would expect this, that if you have more bulk carbon, probably there's more permanganate oxidizable carbon. But if you normalize it by the carbon content, we still see differences between the seasonal to near surface to permanently saturated conditions. In that it's not just the amount or the bulk amount of carbon that's controlling this, but also there's a difference in reactivity. And so then what the other thing that we're interested in is the relationship between soil saturation and the CO2 flux to the atmosphere. And so the idea here being, if we never get to a period here that has oxygen diffusing into the sediments, that you won't see aerobic metabolism in any of these sediments, and that you'll have, over an annual cycle, less carbon or CO2 flux from the sediments. And so we went out to try to actually measure this, and measuring it in these permanent, on the permanent wetlands is very difficult. But we've started to do it in these seasonal wetlands, where we can try to make relationships between soil saturation and CO2 flux. And so we do this with a LICOR instrument and a monitoring chamber, that we monitor at various sites. We can't get continuous data with a set manifold, because I think it would disappear in the field, actually. So this is basically new data going up to just earlier, or just last month. And what this shows is the soil moisture content here, and this is at one site, and you can see the CO2 flux increasing as the soil moisture decreases, and then decreasing again as the soil moisture rebounds. This is the onset of the rainy season. And here, I can't actually explain why we had this dip, but it's quite interesting, and unfortunately we had some technical issues here with the CO2 flux measurements, but I think we still see a rebound here with the CO2 flux that relates to the soil moisture content. And so this is just one example from one site. If we plot more manifold or more sites with soil moisture, we can see a relationship between the CO2 flux and soil moisture content, at least for these types of wetland sediments. And it follows a fairly nice trend, I think, where we have, as we increase the soil moisture content, we see a decrease in the CO2 flux. And I would imagine that there's a point over here where they also reach desiccated conditions, and you would have another drop-off in CO2 flux. But in these sediments, we just never reach any period where we're limited by the water content as far as we can measure. So we had our best attempts at trying to also measure this in permanently saturated areas on a sort of a boundary area where we can access a permanently saturated area and then still make the measurements. Unfortunately, I think it was a atypical year, and at this time the manifold actually became unsaturated, which is unanticipated. But what it did allow us to do was to show, kind of again, although we don't have the direct soil moisture measurements to go along with it, that we see a large pulse of CO2 coming out when dry conditions come to the site. And we saw this again to quite high CO2 fluxes. And what we're really looking at is the differences in the duration of these pulses and what's controlling them, and whether or not as these deltas undergo quite large land use changes, there are a lot of proposed dams on the Mekong River that could change the hydrology, whether or not this is something that we need to include in modeling the CO2 flux to the atmosphere. And so here I've plotted soil moisture from a nearby site, just to kind of illustrate what these processes look like. And so kind of to summarize what we think our conceptual model is here, on permanently saturated areas, we see lower CO2 flux generally, and then on seasonally saturated areas, higher CO2 flux during the dry season. And that during the wet season, where this is the same site, but under the wet season, we see comparable CO2 fluxes to the from the sediments. And so depending on the amount, the duration of these saturated and unsaturated conditions, it could make quite a large difference in what the CO2 efflux is to the atmosphere. And so what we've tried to do with this data now and what we're working on actively is to try to close the carbon mass balance on a few of these sites. And this is about how far we've gotten so far. We have DOC measurements and DIC measurements going out through lysimeters and through wells. We have basically a sediment deposition rate that we've constrained with the amount of the carbon content in these sediments as inputs, and we can calculate basically an average annual CO2 flux. We're at the point where we have nearly enough data to do that. What we don't have well constrained yet is the primary productivity at these sites, which varies across a few of the sites, and we haven't been able to measure that yet. But overall, what's controlling these, controlling the carbon balance in these sites is basically the differences between primary productivity and CO2 flux. And since the CO2 flux is so dependent on the soil moisture, we think that this is really a key to determining how carbon's processed in these sites. And so with that, I'd like to thank a few of the staff that we work with in Cambodia who take a lot of time to collect a lot of these measurements when we're not there. And then I'd open it for any questions that you might have. Thanks.
You will have a couple of minutes for questions for Michael.
Yeah, so we collect soil. The question was whether we collected soil temperature as well. And we collect the soil temperature. It actually comes as a parameter with soil moisture. And so we're actually collecting the soil temperature at the same time. One of the reasons that we really like working in this site is it's a pretty tropical climate. And the variation in temperature in the maximum temperatures, say if you take the monthly average, is about 3 degrees Celsius throughout the entire year. And so it actually helps us to kind of eliminate that as one of the, I mean, it doesn't completely eliminate it, but there's not a strong seasonal variation in soil temperature. When we have water flooding, we do see stronger changes in soil temperature. That's something that we still need to look into further, I guess. Thank you.